problem here a couple of summers ago, 4th of July, and I apologize for this because as he had known here, a lot of other poets, but I wrote a parody on part of it. Because when I sing it, I can't really be with it because it's no longer true for much of our land. This song is more appropriate. Oh, how detestable for smog-filled skies, for contaminated waves of grain, for scavenged mountains lying scarified above the smoke-filled plain. Oh, shame on you for what you do. You haven't seen beyond the years. For every day thy cities spew smog-producing human tears. Now, this feeble attempt at parody, I introduced this most perplexing problem that certainly one of the most difficult to face. We have been calling our nest ever since that great Viking Leif Erikson discovered these shores. And initially, our unspoiled land was able to really take care of all this. But it's no longer true. The present population of the world, 3.3 billion, will double to almost 7 billion by the year 2000. And we'll get into the subject, I think, of overpopulation while I'm here, I hope. I think there's several of you who are interested in this, and we usually have a ring-dang-do discussion on it. Now, I have here with me, from our library, don't come in. they need to hear this probably more than anybody else. They're going to have to live around here longer than the rest of us. I have in my hand what we call a Tukey report. It's the restoring quality of our environment. Ours is, and this is signed by one Lyndon B. Johnson. He doesn't write very clearly, but I can tell it. Ours is a nation of effluents, but the technology that has permitted our effluents spews out vast quantities of waste and spent products that pollute our air, poison our waters, and even impair our ability to feed ourselves. At the same time, we have crowded together in dense metropolitan areas where concentration of waste intensifies the problem. Pollution now is one of the most pervasive problems of our society. With our numbers increasing and with our increasing urbanization and industrialization, the flow of pollutants to our air, soils, and waters is increasing. This increase is so rapid that our present efforts in managing pollution are barely enough to stay even. They're really not staying even. Surely not enough to make the improvements that are needed. Our whole economy seems to be based on taking natural resources, converting them into things for the consumer, and selling them to him, and then forgetting about them. Now, there's a real hooker in this, because unfortunately, there are no consumers. They're only users. I mean, this is a false thing to say people are consumers. We have to begin by closing the loop, sort of from the user back to the resource and reuse. Until very recently, our disposal system was based on throwing things away. But unfortunately, there aren't very many aways anymore, you know? Now, perhaps, in the context of this then, the way I'm going to approach this is to sort of look at the extent of the problem, and I hope we get something on the solution, and I'm going to discuss it sort of on solids, water, and air. Air being our, I think, the most important probably, so we'll leave that to last, so I'll skim over these. But on pesticides, I should mention this. Now, you'll notice that I'm not talking about sort of nuclear energy contaminants from here, because that's a sort of a separate entity. But I will say this, if you don't get to hear that, I have to say this, I try to say it objectively, although this is the area I've been in much of my life, that if all our hazards were as well defined as the hazards from nuclear energy, we'd be in great shape. And if we took the precautions that we do in nuclear energy with all other things, we wouldn't really have any kind of a serious problem because there's no industrial hazards defined to the extent that those from nuclear energy are defined. I'll get into that on another occasion. If you want to challenge this later in this hour, you can. Now, the problem of pesticides, and this is a real one, and it bothers a lot of people. It's a bane and a blessing. And things sort of changed when DDT came on the scene, you know, and from there we've gone steadily into great production of various facets of it. There are some interesting things I can tell you about this, but it is seems strange to a lot of people. And the ecologists, the bird lovers, become very concerned about this, because when you spread some DDT maybe in Ceylon or in Imperial Valley, California, it may end up in the birds in the Arctic or the Antarctic. And people get concerned when they find DDT in the penguins. And if you don't believe it, you ought to meet some of these people that are concerned about them. Now, on the solid wastes, the land pollution staggers the imagination. For each person in these United States has to get rid of 4.5 pounds of waste every day. Now, if you try adding that up, or multiplying it, or whatever you do, you look at all the paper, the grass, the brush, the garbage, the ashes, the metal, the glass, ceramic. This amounts to almost a ton a year for every person. That's like 300 billion pounds a year, huh? Or you can put it in tons. But it's really staggering. It costs $2 billion a year to get rid of it. This is a very substantial quantity of material, and as I say, we're running out of a way. Now, for a time, you know, we used a lot of paper and a lot of tin cans. Well, if you're around for a while, you know, tin cans rust, and paper sort of goes away. We're doing much better than that now. We use aluminum, and we use plastics. And plastics sort of last forever, huh? So, or if you burn some of these plastics, then you get some toxic stuff in the air, you know? So we're really improving. We have 48 billion metal cans a year, 26 billion bottles and jars, 65 billion metal and plastic bottle caps. And then they got these disposable cans, so you pull off these things now and throw them away. Paper cans, as I indicated, and tin cans do rust out, but we've gotten far better than that. And another thing I just learned very recently, René Devoe, who's quite an outstanding scientist in this country, he won sort of the American equivalent of the Nobel Prize, the, I don't know, it's called the Pacific Science Prize or something. I think he's worth quite a bit of money in a way. He seemed awful happy when he visited us in a way. Like he just gotten quite a few $1,000s, but he said, he called my attention to this, you know, we worry about what comes out of cars, you know, but he says probably one of the greatest contributors to the solids in the atmosphere are the wearings from tires and brake linings, the colloidal material, and this was a real surprise to me. I just never had given this much thought. And another one that really shakes me, and I get mad every time I drive down our highways, you know. Boy, people drive on the highways and it's like they think it's a garbage dump, you know, and throw it out the window, you know. It costs us 32 cents an item that's thrown out of the windows on our highways. This amounts to about $2,500 per mile on the highway to clean it up. This is what we're facing in this. And I was going to save it till later, but I can't, you know. I mean, the same thing applies here. One of the reasons I give this lecture, and I give it early, because when I go hiking on the trails, and I don't have much time hiking on trails here when I'm here in for any long hike during the summer, but I come back in September to rest. And I don't like to walk up to Heart Lake, which is really my favorite spot, and see all these candy wrappers and all this cluttered up along the trail. It just infuriates me, huh? So knock it off, right? I was watching Al, you know. Al was cleaning out all our gutters here. All that stuff, all these straws and everything laying in the gutters. Gutters aren't for those. We got garbage pails for them. And we have to educate our children in this. But I'm getting to the last subject before I even get through the first and second. Water contamination. 2 years, or three, maybe it's 4 years ago, you remember the northeastern states were suffering from a water shortage, huh? New York City was drought-stricken. And things had really gotten a desperate situation. Yet the Hudson River was flowing by at the rate of 30,000 gallons per second, but it was really too filled to utilize. The Great Lakes, one quarter of the world's supply of fresh water. The water levels are decreasing and the pollution is increasing. Lake Erie has probably been the hardest hit. It's a dumping ground for sewage and industrial waste from four states in the province of Canada, and they're all kind of racing to see who can do it the best or the worst. In 1936, in Lake Erie, they caught 20 million pounds of blue pipe. I think within the last couple of years, if you totaled it all up, they probably caught 1,000 pounds. And this is a real sorry situation. Lake Michigan is fast becoming polluted. And it isn't only these. I mean, take almost any river, huh? Even this one, huh? From these mine tailings. Take any river. Take Lake Washington. Well, what a mess that is. Huh? For when we were living there for a while, when I was at the University of Washington, they were hesitating to let people swim in it. What happens is that sewage and detergents, you see, we dump them in the lakes, they fertilize the algae, and the algae do very well. They consume the oxygen, and then nothing can really live there. No oxygen, no fish. Huh? Sewage disposal is a real mess. That's the understatement of the day. And we discharge raw sewage from about 50 million of our population into our rivers. And that's a staggering thing to me. The cost of cleaning up our waters would probably approach $75 billion over the next couple of decades. I mean, this is a lot of change. Now, what about the air? Now, some of you can probably immediately say, well, it isn't only man that contaminates the air. And some of you historians will recall for me that in 79 AD, Pliny the Elder died from smog, really, because he was, I guess he was peering into Mount Vesuvius and he got too much sulfur oxide. And so nature sometimes produces some of these, you see. Or in our pine, or in our fir forest, the terpenes. Sometimes you can see a blue haze over a large forest. These are terpenes. Or you remember this big explosion of the Krakatoa, or whatever you call it. Larry will tell you how to pronounce it. Remember in 18, well, some of you don't remember this. It's a few of us. In 1883, in the East Indies, we really blew a big one, you know. I mean, a lot of people say, well, these bombs we're making now are pretty big. But this was really something, you know. It sort of darkened the sky for hundreds of miles. And it sort of colored the sunsets and sunrises over the whole Earth for many months. And there was a lot of debris in the air. But really, since that time, in fact, ever since the invention of fire, man has really outdone nature by long ways. Now, on this subject of air, or I should say first, I noted here an ad that was in a New York City paper that said, "When tomorrow morning when you get up, take a nice deep breath. It will make you feel awful." Sponsored by the Citizens for Clean Air. As one thinks about the mass of the air above us, and it's really a fantastic amount, there's about 2.5 million tons of air for every man, woman, and child in the world. We consume about 30 pounds a day. Now, it's almost impossible then to believe that with all this up here, why can't we just burn some stuff and emit some stuff up there, since after all, where most of our output is in the urban centers, and they only cover about 1% of the Earth's surface. But unfortunately, what is happening, as those of you who live at least in the LA basin realize, that it doesn't always blow away, you know, it's sort of locked in with us. It isn't diluted in this 10 miles above us, but it sometimes gets trapped. And then you're in real deep trouble. Man can do without water for days and with food for weeks, but you can't hold your breath for more than a couple of minutes. You've got to have air. Some of you may recall that back in 1948, and I remember it well, the polluted air sickened almost half the population of Donora, Pennsylvania. Almost half the population were ill. It killed 20 on that occasion. In 4 days in 1952, there was an excess death of 4,000 in London. And over the next number of months following this, there was an increase of several thousand dead In 15 days in 1963, it killed 400 excess deaths in New York City. It kills a lot of other people, this contaminated air. Only it isn't popular to put on the death certificate air pollution. I mean, it isn't one of those that you really utilize, you see. And also, you can't really probably pin it on it, you see. But no doubt air pollution along with cigarette smoking is contributing to the 20-fold increase in cancer since in the last three decades. At the present time, cancer of the lung is our biggest killer of the male population. And the women will catch up as the statistics catch up because more women are now smoking. But a combination of smoking and air pollution will take care of quite a few. Now, there are more poisons that are pumped into the air over New York City than anywhere else in the world. But you from Los Angeles Basin, you come probably a pretty close second. And it's really, really sad. I've taken part in some research involved in symposia there out of Caltech, out of Pasadena. And boy, I just get ill because I was down there several decades ago, and it's really sad. The nursery people are moving out, and it's just kind of a sickening look to. And I've flown in there. Sometimes we couldn't land because of the smog. And it's not only the large cities. One fellow who had come from Missoula, Montana, he went to New York, and he just couldn't stand the dirty smoke in New York City. So he decided that, he remembered all that nice clean air out in Missoula, you know. So he moved back to Missoula. Unfortunately, now Missoula is the second worst smog area in the country. They used to have a sign outside of Missoula that said Big Sky Country. Somebody crossed out the big and put Dirty Sky Country. The same thing, you can say it's Denver. I mean, a lot of people went out to Denver because, boy, nice clean air, Mile High City. And now it's kind of a mess. Roses shrivel and die. They have more sinus trouble. They got to wash their curtains every week and stuff like that, you know. Or Chicago. I was back in Chicago. There was a meeting. And I used the library. I had a few hours off, and I went over to the library. And it was really a dirty place. And I wondered, you know, why they had sinks on every floor, you know, in the stacks. Finally figured out, you use a book, and then you got to go and wash your hands. Oh, it was really a crummy place. University of Chicago. Now every American city of more than 50,000 people has an air pollution problem. Serious enough to worry about. We're introducing, of course, we're thinking of new things to introduce to the air. And there's also, of course, even if we clean it up, there's what we call a cosmic joker in the deck. Because if we do clean up, right now I notice a statistic here, and I'm getting a lot of statistics, and I don't expect you to remember them, but I'm trying to point out to you the magnitude of the problem. If you can imagine 150 million tons of gunk going into the air every year, I mean, this is what we're dealing with, 150 million tons. But a lot of people are very worried right now, because even if they lick this problem of this release to the atmosphere and getting rid of a lot of this junk, they're worried about this carbon dioxide that's accumulating in our atmosphere. And in fact, there's some very dire predictions being made about this, because over the last, probably in this century, we probably had at least a 25% increase of the CO2 in the atmosphere. And if we burn our fossil fuels at the predicted rate by the year 2000, we'll have, of course, increased the CO2 content of the air even much more. And what happens when you have a layer of carbon dioxide, it acts like, it allows sort of the heat to come in, but not to escape. It has a greenhouse effect. Some people are predicting by the year 2000 or so, there will be a 4 to 7 degree increase in temperature on the Earth. And they said that will settle the problem, because this will melt many of the glaciers, the glacial ice, It will raise the level, sea level, at least 100 or so feet, and then it will essentially drown out Los Angeles Basin and Manhattan, and thus eliminate the problem. Air. It's a bit like that little button I saw the other day, and I tried to wrestle the fellow for it. It says, cancer cures smoking. Now there are others who will argue with this and say that, well, it's true that our temperature has, our mean temperature has increased about 1.7 Celsius since 1950. For a period in the 40s and 50s, there was a slight decrease. So we don't know. You see, it's hard to predict just how much CO2 will be utilized. But there are some real hookers in this thing that are causing some people to stay awake at night. Now, we have a little time here, and I hope that you take part in some discussion now as to what are you as citizens going to do about it? What are we going to do about it, you know? And to introduce this, I thought of this yesterday, and I thought about it, I think ever since Paul used to come, started coming here. I started coming about 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, in the field of science, you know, boy, isn't it great, you know, boy, look at all we can do. And because you can do it, you got to do it, you know. If we're going, I mean, if we can go to the moon, boy, we better go there, you know. Or if you have a method that's really unique, you better use it. If you can put out these products and you can get the suckers to buy it, you better put it out, huh? You've got to utilize all these products of science. But the question is, really, do you, you know, do you? Have we gotten such a fix on this that if you got to use it, you know? Of course, we don't use it all, you know. I mean, we were selling Buicks for a long time, weren't we? More power than you'll ever need. We buy a lot of power we don't need, you know. Boy, we're right in America. Huh? So technology is a great paradox. The bane and the blessing. I'll get into more of this on another occasion. But it's a social benefactor, but it's also a social calamity, and certainly in this area. Now, what are we going to do about it? Well, I think we have to go to science and technology and say, all right, boy, some of you got us here, you better get us out of it, you know. I mean, there's a lot of glamour in some science. A lot of it isn't very much glamour. And I suppose if you talk to a scientist and you say, well, what do you do? You know, and he says, well, I'm working on garbage, you know. Or I'm trying to figure out, something on how to get rid of old beer cans. Huh? I mean, it doesn't sound too glamorous. And I suppose maybe that's why a lot of people haven't been utilizing, you know, getting involved in it. I mean, it isn't a very exciting area to try to get rid of garbage. But I think we've gotten to that point now. And I've written down a few things here, but before I do it, I mean, what do you think we ought to do about it? I mean, what are some of the solutions that come to your mind or that you've read about?
How about you put ten bucks for garbage stuff?
We might find some other use for them sometime, and we don't probably have that many. What's our greatest contaminant in many of the cities? It's really automobiles. Well, what are we going to do about that?
How about the jet?
The jet takeoff is about 80 pounds or so into the air, but and you it is a problem, right? But it just doesn't compare to automobiles.
There are ways of controlling smog and auto exhaust and things like that, but it's just not required by law.
Yeah, in California it is. Now, I have a device in my car. For a lot of people, they bypass them. If you've had them in your car for a while, they're not efficient. It cuts down. I mean, what is the... most cars emit about 700 parts per million. Their exhaust. There's a law in California now cutting it to 250. By, 1970, it'll be down to 100. But you know, we don't really test this very often. My car's never been tested for this. Is yours, Paul?
Well, I had a second-hand Cadillac before I could relicense it in my own name and required it on a device. But there was a device on it, and most of it was made, but it couldn't have been always on it.
Well, there is a great activity in California right now. And they're saying, right, by 1980, no more gas eating automobiles in California. Yeah. It may have to work.
Which automobile that would be used?
Pardon?
They've never been able to define which automobile that would permit being used. There are no automobiles at the present time coming with that definition, come within that definition. And as you know, it's a hassle in California.
How about the machine people?
Well, that's probably worse. Hydrocarbon consuming.
What about electric cars?
Yeah, of course, there's the crash program on electric automobiles right now by Ford, by General Electric, by some of the foreign producers. I think Chrysler too, probably. There's a very great activity in this, and this is certainly. Or hoping that the technology comes up with something else. The first proposal made was that maybe we'll have a combination. That maybe you'd run your gas eating automobile from way out in the, maybe you're coming from Bakersfield and you'd turn it off up on the, coming over the Tehachapi or whatever you call it, into the basin, and then you'd have to go on electric car. There's also, you know, this thought of this, of this road where you essentially are in a track, and it's sort of like electric trolley where you drive your car up on it and you're getting car this way.
How about detergent?
You have to change all this. I mean, you're talking about water contamination. You know. Yeah, there are saleable now detergents that do not cause all this foaming. This kind of thing. And I hope that's where they're putting your body.
Is that still not harmful to fish?
Well, I don't know if they really run with acid petrol. I haven't been associated with this. I knew something about it about 3 years ago. I haven't run this in the last 3 years. Anything else?
Well, an automobile for these, in Time Magazine about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there's an article, company that was perfecting a steam engine where you'd have a small, I think it was a gallon tank of water that you kept warming at all times so that whatever you wanted to start your engine going, this warm water would circulate with the rest of the water and propel things, but it still used gas and you'd spend 7 cents for going from one coast to the other on gasoline, but otherwise it was quite effective, and its speeds are equal to what they have now.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to, and the steam automobile has been floated. Of course, we used to have one, you know. and we need some radical movements in this regard. How about the area of incineration? I mean, right now, you're not allowed to open burn in L.A., are you? And in San Francisco, and we have some restriction on it in the valley. And also, I mean, these are areas where we really need to look at the problem, you know. I think the European countries are far better developed on incineration. And there are ways of burning things and burning them effectively without too much release in the air. I mean, I think using electronic precipitators and filtration devices and so forth probably can reduce the amount of contamination in the air and burning these. But there's a lot of things we can do before that. On our whole packaging situation, you know, if we get to, I mean, the ideal thing is to be able to eat everything you buy, you know. I mean, throw it all in the soup, you know, like, you know, you go to the store and you buy these peas, you know, and stuff in these plastic containers, you know. At least it says you can throw them in the kettle and they didn't taste too bad. You know, the whole thing goes in and you eat it all. Or to use packaging devices that maybe disintegrate faster or burn easier without the emission of certain gases. Or things that you can reutilize. I mean, we have to make some real developments in this. There's a big contract, in fact, at the University of California, Davis.
on getting rid of solid waste. What's the solution on our power plants?
Well, we do want to hear most of all about the atomic energy. I sometimes wonder whether they may not be released from that.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to that later in the week. I'll just summarize that now because this is a great concern. One of the great contaminants of the atmosphere in many places are coal and oil burning power plants. And in many areas now, in Florida, and even the TVA are now putting in nuclear plants, not only because they're about as efficient as coal and as cheap as coal and oil burning things, but they cause far less contamination of the environment. Now, for a long time, and especially in California was sort of the last one to get on the bandwagon to use atomic energy for power. One of the reasons was that they used the bugaboo of the big hazard. Now, sure, radiation is a hazard. It depends on where you put it and how it's released. And I'll give you a couple of examples in this regard. The restrictions, of course, on nuclear energy are more stringent than almost anything else, and because they recognize the great hazard. But the coal lobby was very active in California, saying that, boy, this nuclear energy is very hazardous because of it releases radioactive material to the environment. And then one fellow, he happens to be on the Lindsay staff now in New York City in charge of all pollution. His name is Merle Eisenbud. And Merle Eisenbud sat down and he figured out what the contamination is in the atmosphere from, say, burning coal for an equivalent amount of production of power versus nuclear energy plant. And it turns out that the release of radioactive material from burning coal is much higher than that from a nuclear power plant. Because you see, you're burning this fuel and there's radium and other things in it, and radium is very hazardous. And with a greater release. The coal lobby hasn't said too much about that since. They've changed their tune, but this nature thing. The other thing is in shipping port reactor. They really got on the shipping port reactor in the east because it was an atomic power producer. And they said, look, if you're contaminating the water, the cooling water, it's going out of here. Look at this, read such and such, and that's beyond the limit. In reality, they really got worried then. But then some wise guy went up in the water coming into the plant. He found out it was even higher. It was higher coming into the plant than going out. In other words, the river they were using was where it was contaminated with radioactive material above the plant. But there are radioactive hazards, and it's a real problem to have proper storage for this as we look ahead for the next 2 or 3 decades. I mean, there's no proper storage and handling. There'll probably be accidents with it. But as far as you don't get an explosion from it.
But we bother with natural gas, we use a lot more of that.
Yeah, but you see, any burning of hydrocarbons releases various materials to the atmosphere.
In some places in Europe, they have solved this problem and also their garbage problem. They have made some very efficient incinerators that dispose of their garbage and put practically nothing in the air, and they make power.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chief. I did mention part of this. Yeah, and that's true. I forgot to mention this. That is, another aspect of this, if you can make containers and all this stuff that we throw out as garbage, if it is burnable, or if you have good incinerators that burn it, you utilize the power from that and also reduce and have an efficient system so you don't release a lot of it in the air. And they have done a lot with this, and we could certainly do a lot more. There's another thing that bugs me on this, and I hope if some of you are in a position to do something about this, I hope you do. And I get sick every time I drive through California to see them tearing up good agricultural land and putting up houses and things like this, you know. Where in reality, there's a lot of land in California that isn't good for agriculture. You could just as well build houses and stuff on, you know. I know real estate people probably don't like to hear this, but it's really
you know, right now, and I'm gonna call on you, Paul, but right now, how many people have we got? We got 19 million, I think. We got the number of cars in California are equivalent to any of the two other leading states. And that's the problem today. We're approaching a disaster situation. And probably in a couple of decades, we'll probably be 42 million, is the prediction. And where are they going to build all the houses, you know? And that's what I'm afraid of. Pretty soon, no land for agriculture. When I get to be dictator, they're not going to do anything. That's Paul.
The developer builder was attempting to serve the public as economically as possible. It so happens that the law of economics is applied that the land that's most suitable for agriculture is also the land that's most suitable for providing economic housing. The difficulty is using land that's not suitable for agriculture and is still in the area where people wish to live, pertaining to the relationship with industry and other forms of occupation. And most of that land is not suitable for agriculture, more like straight up and down the way it is around here. And it is uneconomical to build residences on it. You can develop a true deal of state, such as there is about Beverly Hills, where a pad for a single family residence costs anywhere from $70,000 to $100,000. But this is rather inapplicable to the general needs for housing. You start building straight up and down there, you get the cost of development becomes astronomical. The very wealthy can afford to live there. Well, since the poor people don't want to live out in the ocean, and the only attractive land in which to build development is the agriculture, you get that.
Yeah, I think we've got to change it.
There's a rather basic law of economics involved. The only thought that occurs to me is that we are have an obligation for our best use of land, and in this case, best use is for providing housing, and this causes agriculture to move out where housing isn't needed. And first, probably the land that may not be as perfect as it is along the coast for agriculture, but it is utilizable by means of irrigation.
Yeah.
Because it's reasonably flat, so it will lend itself to agriculture. It's just as impractical to attempt to build single family residences in the low economic, in the low economic bracket. This is impractical to build those on steep slopes as it is against agriculture on steep slopes. We might solve our problem by devoting these people to agriculture. It can be done, but it's not economically practical.
Yeah, for some of these deep folks are not as productive either. I'll give you some examples.
You can pulverize the rock, you can fertilize it, you know, all those sort of things.
Yeah, well, I'll give you two examples in my immediate area. Because I think the time is approaching. We're going to have to exchange convenience for survival. In some of this.
The housing, I would say, is part of the plan. You have a shirt on my back.
I'll give you two examples in our area. One of them is the location of the airport. They took the best agricultural land in the Sacramento Valley and they made a big airport out of it. And it's unfortunate, too, because it's the heaviest fog area. And I don't know why they did it. Where they could have gone up, you know, you were just reasoning Sacramento, they could have gone up on the plateau east of Sacramento. So the land isn't as good.
I hope they do. I've got a bad investment there.
That's what they should have done, you see. And that's a mistake. Somebody goofed, you know. When where we are. Yeah, right. Now, another one, right in Davis, huh? Now, they could have just as well put Davis, just in the move that 13 miles west, huh? Up in the gentler rolling hills, where the land isn't as good. It's only 13 miles away, or if the expansion should be in those hills, or on down, you know, towards San Francisco. Those hills are not very productive in a way, yet they're not so steep as what you couldn't build fairly effective on. The other thing is, I think by convenience and survival, I think that we're going to have to go to a lot more apartment house dwelling than single housing.
Well, and some people think that in apartment houses, we only partially. I haven't been doing
that. Yeah, well, Well, then we'll have to educate the people on the wonders of apartment house living. One of the things I have down here is one of education. We've got to educate the people, because in Sweden they do, unless they goofed up the place later. When I lived in Sweden a few years ago, you go down the subway, I mean, everything's clean. They picked up their paper. They don't throw away the candy wrappers, huh? We just...